The House Committee on Education will come to order. It is, what is today? Thursday, February 9th. If you have a cell phone, please turn it all the way to off and not just to silent so that people can hear us over the internet. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4102, and I would invite Representative Johnson.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Gelser and Chair Wingert, for making this time available. Good to be with you all, other education junkies in the building, like some of us are. So early in the day, too. For some of us, it's actually quite early. For the record, I'm Representative Mark Johnson from House District 52, where I was last night for a school board meeting that went till 9 o'clock. So. However, I'm happy to be here today, and thank you for this opportunity. In the midst of all the energy and the verbiage and attention that is surrounding public education reform, both here in Oregon and across the nation, I think one truth remains constant, that there is no more important relationship in the education continuum than the relationship between teachers and their students. And now as we move into the future of education reform in Oregon, from the proficiency-based Common Core state standards to the potential establishment of outcome-based achievement compacts between each school district and the Oregon Education Investment Board, one factor I believe remains constant, that without effective classroom instruction, none of the coming reforms will result in the desired outcomes. In the last session, the legislature passed Senate Bill 290. This bill put in place a process for this state to begin to intentionally focus on the issue of teacher evaluations. And much good work has been done across this state in recent months as school districts have begun the conversations surrounding evaluation processes and their content. They have been aligning performance standards and the criteria so that they are aligned with core teaching standards across the board. House Bill 4102, and when I refer to this document, I hope you're all looking at the dash 3 amendments because that reflects the reality of the bill as you see it today. House Bill 4102 was crafted with the intent of being the next step in the process to strengthen teacher evaluation systems across the state. House Bill 4102 goes beyond the general outline of Senate Bill 290 and lays out a very specific evaluation system that would apply to both teachers and those administrators who have teacher evaluation responsibilities. This bill calls for specific timelines and provides great detail about the type of evaluations that are to be used by school districts across the state. Let me take a moment to talk about timelines and timing of evaluations. Currently, in statute, each probationary teacher, meaning those teachers that have not yet attained contract status, are to be evaluated every year. And I think we all would agree that that is useful to ensure that they are, in fact, qualified and ready to assume the responsibilities of contract status. But for those teachers who have attained contract status, their evaluation processes are much more indeterminate and are generally determined locally by the school district, and there can be wide varieties on the frequency of teacher evaluation processes. The same applies to administrators or principals who have evaluation responsibilities. Their evaluations can be very sporadic as well, and there is nothing that requires frequency of these evaluations to occur. This bill calls for each teacher and each administrator who has evaluation responsibilities to be evaluated at least every 2 years. In addition to the timing difference, this bill also calls for multiple levels of differentiation regarding job performance. Currently, most evaluation systems as they currently exist across the state of Oregon simply find out or make a determination that a teacher is either satisfactory or unsatisfactory. I guess you could also call it pass-fail. It's been that way for a long time. There's nothing new about that. But the problem is, I believe, that that system doesn't give a lot of data that really helps to ensure that we can know the proficiency of each individual instructor. This bill calls for differentiating among at least four levels of performance. And I'll read those to you so you can understand what we're talking about. Keep in mind, this is instead of satisfactory or unsatisfactory. The new performance levels would say level one would be exceeds performance standards. Level two would say meets performance standards, does not meet performance standards, but demonstrates progress towards meeting performance standards, and does not meet performance standards or demonstrate progress toward meeting performance standards. Much more intensive, much more, I think, helpful as we try to determine how equipped are our teachers, how are they doing in the classroom, and how can we help them to develop into the kind of teachers that I think we all would like to have teaching our kids. The other thing that needs to be pointed out is that this language that's in the bill is identical to the language that the state submitted in its waiver request for the No Child Left Behind waiver. This is exactly what we have told the federal level that we are going to try to impose here in the state of Oregon to govern our teacher evaluation processes. I hope you all can see how much more information may be gleaned from an evaluation that involves multiple levels of performance versus the traditionally satisfactory or unsatisfactory. In addition, House Bill 4102 also calls for taking into account, quote, significant consideration of student learning. Again, let me read from the bill. If I can find it. Sorry. Significant consideration of student learning, which may be determined based on evidence from a combination of any of the following: statewide school academic growth based on data from a statewide assessment system, formative or summative student assessments adopted for use by the school or school district, classroom level assessments agreed upon collaboratively between teachers and evaluators, and any other data that are based on a plan to improve student achievement and that have been adopted by the board. Again, a much more complete, a much more robust system that actually takes into account the performance of students in both in the building level and in the classroom level. Again, this is not a new thought. At the federal level, Arne Duncan and the folks at the federal level are calling for this to be a part of every state as we seek opportunities to be freed from the requirements of No Child Left Behind, but also that this is the way that the evaluation processes are going to be going on a national level. And it must be pointed out also that the National Education Association has approved student learning as a part of evaluation processes. The other thing I'd like you to be aware of is that we designed this bill really to fit in very closely with the philosophy behind the tight-loose concept that is so prevalent today in Oregon education. We're setting out expectations of performance that school districts will comply with. However, how they get there, what the ultimate system that they end up having at the local level, will be the result of a conversation between superintendents, school boards, the teachers, come together to decide what system works best for them in their district, recognizing that as we have 197 school districts across this state, there can be different levels and different expectations, and we don't want to micromanage that process. Superintendents, school boards, and teachers can all participate in the process to determine what works best for their districts to ensure that teachers are able to receive regular and thorough evaluations that can provide information that can lead to professional development opportunities for each classroom instructor as they may need it. House Bill 4102 also includes the same process for administrative staff, meaning typically principals, or those who have teacher evaluation responsibilities. They too are evaluated at least every other year so that their skills are examined within a multiple level performance system that also includes student achievement as a, quote, significant consideration. This would ensure that they would also be trained in the process to help them better be able to evaluate their personnel. Again, school districts are allowed to design a system that works for all stakeholders at the local level, taking into account multiple measures. In crafting this bill, we are very sensitive to the existing bureaucratic demands that are placed upon our school districts. Instead of imposing another time-consuming reporting mandate upon our districts, this bill simply requires that A, the superintendent shall report to his or her board at least annually about how the process is going. Regular communication between the superintendent, his or her board member, they can talk about the process. Is it working? Is it not working? How might we approve the process? What are the outcomes that we're finding? B, each district shall provide ODE with a written copy of the process, simply notifying them of what they are doing and then any subsequent changes that they may employ as time goes on. And lastly, the implementation piece. Teacher evaluations under this bill that occur after September 1st of 2013 will need to meet these criteria. This is a vast improvement on the waiver request timing, which provides for a much more, I'll just say, a much less certainty about how the process will come to be, and exactly at the end of that process, what outcomes will be in view. This provides certainty so that many districts are able to move into this system, I believe, relatively quickly. We have districts across the state like Salem-Keizer, Ben Lapine, Portland Public, who already have very robust systems in place that they are currently working with. And I think from my perspective, it would not be a big, it would not be difficult for these districts to move into this new system without a great deal of work. However, I do recognize and acknowledge that there could be problems for smaller districts who may have fewer resources. And I would envision a time where this could be a collaborative relationship with ESDs that could also come in and help perform some of these evaluations. It could be another key part of that process, and I do believe that we have the representative representing Oregon Small Schools here today who can speak to that issue if you would so desire. Now, if I could for just a minute, I would like to take off my representative hat and put on my school board member hat. As we talk about a lot of the issues that are currently being kicked around this building, from achievement compacts to some of the other big issues, big reforms that are being considered, it's important for all of us to recognize that in order for these reforms to be successful, the school boards at the local level need to be empowered with tools. We need tools to help us manage our districts efficiently. We need tools to help us look into the classrooms within our districts to ensure that our staff have what they need to be successful. If we have these kind of tools, your school boards across this state stand willing and eager and excited to launch into the future. But I ask you and I implore you that as you adopt some of these reforms that are envisioned and are coming down the line here relatively quickly, please remember that the rubber meets the road at the school district level. It meets the road within those school district boardrooms and those collaborative discussions between superintendents and school board members, and they're asking for your help to give them the tools that they need to be successful. In closing, we can't lose sight that the ultimate focus of all reforms that are currently being debated in this building are about kids. What are we going to do to ensure that each and every kid in our public education system has the opportunity to reach his or her potential for their own benefit and the benefit of our state? And I believe that House Bill 4102 before you today in the form of the -3 amendments can be a significant improvement and help us moving down that road towards the reforms and the achievements that I think we all desire. So thank you, Madam Chair. I anxiously entertain any questions, and there are a lot smarter people than me behind me that would like to talk to you about this bill as well.
Thank you. Are there questions for Representative Johnson? Representative,
the guy on the end.
The guy on the end.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, maybe I missed it. Beyond or as a part of the evaluation, is there anything that directs the, let's say a principal is doing the evaluation, is there anything to direct them to give guidance, an action plan to the teacher?
Absolutely.
You need improvement, and here's what I recommend you do.
Chair Gelser and Representative Huffman, yes, great question. Thank you. The process would begin with a pre-conference. between the evaluator and the instructor, talking about job description, about goals, about hopes for them personally. How are they doing? What are their particular needs? At the end of the process, the evaluation process, there's a post-evaluation conference as well, where, again, depending on where that instructor would fit within the four differentiated levels, they can talk about specific areas of improvement or look at specific areas that could be improved via specific staff development programs that are available within the district or that district can bring to bear for that instructor. So absolutely. It's about differentiated evaluation processes that you would have unique outcomes, I'm guessing, for virtually every teacher.
Just a quick follow-up comment. I come from a different world, not education, from business background. And in my background, I would find it amazing that there was any employer-employee situation where there wasn't already this communication going on, evaluation, and trying to sharpen and make sure that everybody was the best they could be.
Absolutely, Rep. Puffin, I would agree. I think, again, within the private sector, we certainly see that often. We have very detailed evaluations of how we are doing, you know, and the point is behind this is to ensure that we can be as productive as we possibly can be, that we can be as good and prepared for whatever our responsibilities are within the workforce. But again, within education, we haven't had that degree of specificity in most places. Some states and some districts, obviously, have gone way beyond where we are currently in Oregon. But this would be a vast improvement and, again, a tool to help superintendents, to help school board members to really understand the level of competence and the level of preparedness to teach in these new challenging environments. And I do believe you're going to have testimony submitted into the record today from a teacher, from a former teacher who, for the length of her career, received really, in her estimation, zero effective evaluations just because the process wasn't in place that would allow her supervisors to really give her good substantive feedback on where she was and how she could improve her classroom efforts.
Thank you. Rick Simconger.
So a comment and then a question. Comment is, first of all, thank you for your hard work on this bill. I know this has been an issue that you're particularly concerned about and been focused on for a while, and I know a lot of work has gone into this, notwithstanding that you're only on dash 3 amendments. I mean, if you were on dash 12 or something, it'd be more impressive. sorry.
We'll take that under advice.
Give him some time.
It is a short session, so you haven't had time.
Yeah, exactly.
So I appreciate the work that you've done on it, and I am a fan. And one of the things that I've talked to you about, and I just want to mention for the record, is the importance that I have heard from talking to teachers in my community of leadership. And these institutions are very people-oriented. So I don't want to compare it to a law firm, but in that sense, it's very similar to the business that I operate in, where what matters are the quality of the law firm is dependent on the quality of the people and the people leading the institution. I think schools are very similar. The quality of the teachers makes an enormous amount of difference, but so does the quality of the folks who are mm-hmm. leading the school. And so I thought it was extremely important that this bill include the same kind of treatment of leadership in terms of having that two-way communication, both the critique, but then the hopefully the follow-up and the improvement, the constant improvement of administrators. So I appreciate having that in here. And the question is, to me, this is a sort of a first step in what should be a comprehensive, systemic, institutionalized effort to improve the people who are so key to the success of the institution. First step is that communication, but there are other parts of it. For example, linking compensation to extra effort by people, so that, you know, my hope or my expectation would be that at some point, if you have a teacher who is overperforming or who gets in and works hard and shows improvement or who is capable of mentoring other teachers and bringing, you know, exerting that leadership, that there's a reward for them. And conversely, someone who just isn't suited and just isn't capable, there's a path out the door that's reasonably quick. And so the question, which I'll finally get to, is, and I'm asking this, I think, with your school board hat on.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like the school board has the flexibility with this system in place to then work with the teachers to get the other pieces that I'm talking about in place as well?
Representative Conger, thank you for that question. I think it would certainly be a helpful tool, obviously, as we can move from the realm of simply pass-fail in an evaluation process to something that has multiple levels of differentiation to really find out who truly are those who are excelling at what they do. And within what's currently going on within public education right now, there are opportunities for those teachers who are truly exemplary to not be compensated for their efforts, but to give them greater responsibility, put them into a mentoring role, which allows them then to, as iron sharpens iron, so to speak, to share their skills with peers to help raise everybody's level. I would suppose if, obviously, you could go down that road. That's not in view in this piece of legislation, certainly. But it would allow for differentiation between those who are truly exemplary, and if in fact the district wanted to compensate that in some fashion, that would be their prerogative, I'm sure. Is that what your question was?
That really was the question. I'll just may have follow up with a comment. I think it's great, and in some ways it's motivational to give people more responsibility. For many people it is. But I also think to the extent that you ask people to add to their responsibilities at their job, mm-hmm. there should be some opportunity to reward them monetarily. And so my hope is that school boards would be able to take this system and reward those exemplary teachers or the teachers who are exerting the extra effort and willing to take on the extra responsibility and put in the extra hours. There's no reason that they shouldn't be rewarded.
And just to follow up, Rep. Conger, districts do that now, but it's called extra duty contracts. You know, they can be a trainer, if you will, of other teachers, and there are methodologies for providing extra compensation for them should they choose to step out in a more advisory or a supervisory role.
Thank you.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Representative Kelsey. Hello, sir. How are you?
Very well, thank
Good.
You.
Good. Glad to see you. A couple of questions, a couple of comments, and a couple of questions. In my experience, primarily in the Portland schools, but also looking across the district, but specifically in the Portland schools, we reached a capacity issue. We began to cut back on administrators to the point where they didn't have the time, the ability to go into to do the evaluations that they wanted to do. And many of the evaluations are the kinds of things that you're talking about. How do we deal with that? Because that is a capacity issue, as you mentioned, for small districts. It's also a capacity issue for large districts that have cut back people so much that they really can't do the kind of work that they would like to do. Any suggestions on that?
Short of funding education at the QEM.
Oh, thank you for saying that. I did not plug that. You will get $20 on it, however, so thank you.
Chair, can I second that motion?
Short of that, Representative Frederick, which of course I have no control over. You're right. There are obviously in this budget climate, there are areas where staffing can be less than desirable. If you'll notice on the dash threes, we define who the quote-unquote administrator is. It would not have to be a licensed administrator. It could be a principal, or it could be another individual who has teacher evaluation responsibility. So there is flexibility, I believe, in the wording here to not necessarily mean that we're talking about district-level individuals who are the only ones that can perform those evaluations, or in a situation where they're you may have someone in a supervisory role who could be, because of lack of other opportunities, there be given this evaluation responsibility.
The problem with that is that most of the supervisors were cut as well. And in the Portland schools, they eliminated two whole departments that were doing that kind of evaluation. And so you ended up with it being the principal, and then we cut back the vice principal. So you didn't have very many people who were available to do that kind of thing. They're trying to rebuild, but this is a concern that I would encourage you to think about as well. On a couple of other quick things, if you don't mind. I don't know of a teacher that I've ever met who wakes up in the morning trying to figure out how much more money they're going to make that day. They aren't in it for compensation. I've never seen anyone do that. If they are, they don't stay very long because there's not a lot to be compensated on in terms of financially. So so far the studies that I've seen don't indicate that that compensation either adds to or increases the quality of education for the kids in that situation. I do, however, know that, as you mentioned, you do have teachers who want to teach and teach not just the students, but also help other teachers. It's a really great thing to work with, and they are very effective on that. But they also are relying a lot on how we select teachers. And I'm going to go back to another thing that I've seen, and that's around the world. Some of the places that are doing extremely well are selecting teachers in a different way than we are, not trying to train them or discipline them into being good teachers, but before they get into the teaching profession, they find themselves being selected as the top folks for that. I'd like to begin to speak to that kind of situation as well, not so much the evaluation approach, because by that time they're in the classroom in front of the kids. And I was a reasonably good teacher at a certain point, but my first year, not so much. So the evaluations, though, that I got my first year helped me in my second year as I taught. So that's the kind of thing that I'd like to see happen. And it was a very robust evaluation at the time. But that was at a time when the administration and the supervisory capabilities in Portland were significant. They are not now. So, thank you.
Just to follow up, if I might, Chair Gels and Reverend Frederick, what you're suggesting, what you're referring to, I think, is that during that probationary period, the state still does require at least annual evaluations of probationary teachers for the exact reasons that you laid out there, to make new teachers, help them to attain those skills and that confidence, so that when they attain contract status, that the district and the teacher are sure that this is a right fit for both of them.
Thank you.
Representative Dimbro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Rep. Johnson, thanks for giving us the chance to talk about this subject, which is, you know, it's, I think, as has been said, it really is at the heart of what makes our schools effective, the degree to which teachers can be, you know that they will be supported, will be worked with, will be assessed, and can grow as professionals. And I really value that you're able to bring your own direct experience as a school board member. I have a few questions that I want to kind of pin down. I think there's still some looseness in this, set of amendments, and I want to try to get some clarity. Before I do, though, I just want to put on the record, just echoing what Representative Frederick said about paper for performance. You know, I think that the record is very mixed on the effectiveness of pay for performance. We just recently received a report from NCSL, the National Conference of State Legislatures, looking at some comprehensive research, which shows that the results are mixed. The results on giving people pay for added duties is good, and that gets people to do things that need to be done and helps them to grow as professionals. So there, the record seems pretty clear, but it's still very mixed on pay for performance. At the heart, I think, of what you're proposing here is the issue of the use of student learning and the significant use of student learning. What do you mean by significant in this context?
Well, Representative Dimbro, thank you. That's a question that's being debated across the country, and it is being defined in a lot of different ways. Some states have gone down a pathway where they have mandated specific percentages of an evaluation need to be based on student learning, and that could be based on, in Oregon here we have the Oaks test, we have a state standardized test, other states have different methodologies and so forth, but some states are saying up to 50% of an evaluation is directly attributed to whatever performance, however they want to measure that, whether it's year over year, They have metrics available in certain states that we don't have here. So it varies from state to state and region to region. I don't think, I guess from my perspective, and I think how the perspective is across the state or across the country, and I know, I believe what we'll probably end up here in Oregon is that it's not that we have a definition of quote-unquote what that means, but the point is that we are allowing local levels to have conversations about what they think it would best mean for them. That's what I think this bill has in mind, and that's what I think the federal folks are promoting, is that they want the conversation to happen because it really hasn't been an intentional part of an evaluation process to this point. So how that's quantified based on what data is available at each state and how they want to implement any of those other local measures that they could enfold in there as well. I would just add that within the administrator principal evaluation piece, part of the performance of his or her building, if you will, as a principal, could factor into that principal's evaluation as well. And that's something we've never looked at before as a motivating tool to ensure that they want to make sure that their teachers are evaluated, that they are functioning at their highest capability, so that there should be a direct cause-effect relationship in student achievement as well.
Right. So just following up, so the determination of what constitutes a significant level, do you see that being decided on district by district? But we consider this, we've been told that we have to include a significant amount, and we say it's this much.
Representative Demmer, I envision that being handled at a local level, just like other collective bargaining decisions are handled at the local level. Mm-hmm. Not in that sort of an arena, but a collaborative, let's come together and talk about this and let's arrive on it's something that we all can take ownership in. I'm talking about obviously management through the superintendent, the administration, the school board, and the actual teachers that are involved. Right. I think we all would agree that a collaborative approach would work best for everyone in multiple areas within districts to bring, again, as we, they're going to have to come together also to have those conversations about achievement compacts if we end up going down that road as well. So there's going to be the need for greater collaboration and working together at all levels of school districts than we currently have seen.
Right. So following up, you mentioned collective bargaining, and, evaluation is an element, I think, in every collective bargaining agreement. It's probably a mandatory subject of bargaining. And so that determination of what constitutes a significant amount, so you see that being something that would be decided on through collective bargaining?
I think it could be in that arena, but I think
it would have to be, wouldn't it?
It could go to that stage, but it wouldn't necessarily need to. We have districts in the state right now that are working towards this, and I don't believe that these are bargaining developments. I think they're collaborative relationships, and as you look at the districts that are chalkboard districts right now, you're seeing significant student achievement being considered into those discussions already. Mm-hmm. But those are districts that have collaborative relationships between management and labor.
But you don't follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. But you don't see this being something that the district could unilaterally impose on the collective bargaining agreement, right?
Representative Dembro, the bill pretty clearly says that it needs to be a collaborative decision,
through collective bargaining.
It doesn't have collective bargaining implicit in the legislation.
Mm-hmm. And why is that?
I just think that Representative Dembro, I think that would tend to make it seem that is the only pathway to get there. I think this bill would have envisioned a much more collaborative approach that wouldn't have to go to that degree.
Okay. If I could follow up just one on this strand. I do see a potential problem here in that, you could have two processes butting against each other where you have a collective bargaining process where evaluation is, very much a part of that. And then you have another one, and the question becomes what supersedes? So, I guess I would ask you, as a school board member, you said that districts need the tools to do things that they're not currently able to do. Okay. So you as a school board member at, Hood River, what is limiting you? What is binding you from being able to do what you think needs to be done as a school board member?
Representative Dembro, as you being in education, as you are, and have been and continue to be. You recognize that sometimes change comes slowly, that there are multiple factors that limit our, from both perspectives. It's difficult to sometimes get desired outcomes by just simply suggesting, why don't we try this? I think the value of this would be that this would set a statewide expectation, particularly in regards to the multiple levels of evaluation, moving off of just simply the satisfactory, unsatisfactory, because, again, if this is going to be the new expectation or the new standard for these processes, I think it's much more easy for a superintendent to say to his or her, to work with a school board and also with his teachers to say, look, we're going to adopt this new system. Let's work together now to implement this in a way that's good for all. But I think that, again, we have 197 or 196 school districts across the state, and I think that the idea that if we could just have a model that is based on best practices, these are not just, you know, these are not just standards that we just pulled out of the air in putting this bill together. These are best practices that are being employed across the nation already, and these are being developed, these are being used across the state of Oregon in many districts already as well. So it's not without precedent, and it's not without some degree of use and some history to refer back to see how effective and to see what results it's actually achieving at the local level.
And with that, I think I'm going to have to move us on. We have another bill and several work sessions, and we're behind schedule. Are there any quick questions?
Thank you, Madam. Not a question. Just I think we got a little off track. This is my opinion. We got into the incentivizing thing, and I think the bill is more about evaluations and helping teachers be the best they can be and providing them the tools to do that. And I didn't see anything in here that said, if you improve, you know, there's a carrot out here or a stick, you know.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you, Representative Huffman. Thank you, Representative
Thank you.
Johnson. All right, next we will have Morgan Allen, Dana Hepper, and Sue Hildick.
And Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, we did receive testimony from Sue Hildick and Dana Hepper. It was at the dais this morning for you.
Oh, thanks.
And I think before everybody starts, so nobody takes it personally, we have to condense a little bit more than we
No, have. Absolutely. I won't read my testimony. My name's Dana Hepper. I'm the Advocacy Director with Stand for Children, and we're in support of House Bill 4102. And I just wanted to add a few quick points. When I was a member of the Next Generation Accountability Evaluation Work Group, that is the work group that's charged with developing guidelines for new evaluations in Oregon that went into our application for a waiver from No Child Left Behind. And all of the concepts in House Bill 4102 were concepts that were broadly agreed to by the stakeholder committee on that group. And Stand for Children's position is that putting them in law helps make sure that more principals and teachers and students benefit from these broadly agreed upon best practices, and that it will help us earn that needed waiver from No Child Left Behind. I did want to quickly address the question about the definition of significant, because the work group discussed that at length. And what we came up with is, one, significant means that in all of the design processes that are happening around the state to create next generation evaluation systems for principals and teachers, student achievement should be at the heart of those evaluation discussions. The entire design of the evaluation should be created to drive improvements in student achievement. So that's the first piece of significant. And the second piece, for each individual receiving a new evaluation, student achievement should be one component of that evaluation for every individual principal and teacher. So it's those two key factors that were the definition of significant in our No Child Left Behind waiver application. The second point I wanted to quickly make is that we've talked a lot about teachers, but it's very clear we're talking about principals and teachers, and I think principal evaluation, professional development, accountability gets too often overlooked, and I don't want us to overlook it as well. And then three, I think the urgency we're feeling is that school districts are in the process of creating their creating new evaluations right now. I know Portland has a collaborative work group, Eugene has a collaborative work group, and they're looking for clear guidance, direction. And I think ensuring that the first time they design new evaluations, they include some of the key best practices is important. I would hate to have them design evaluations and then a year later have to redesign based on what the state has decided are best practices. If we know what those are now, let's be clear. I'll quickly end with the story from Donna that Representative Johnson referenced. Donna DeForest was a teacher in the Bethel School District for 33 years. She's recently retired. She wanted to come today, but she has a sub job in her old building, so that's where she is. And she was here in Salem last Thursday meeting with legislators, and she met with a couple of you on the committee. And she said that in her 33 years, she never had an evaluation that she really considered meaningful in terms of her professional growth or professional. And to her, she desired a truly professional evaluation. And as an educator, she felt like student growth and student learning and measuring that was a really key component of her job. And she should be able to do that, and something that she wanted to do as a teacher. The last thing I'll say is that I think there are a number of ideas on your docket today that have the potential to positively impact students in Oregon. And so I just hope there is a path for us to work together and reach collaborative solutions to make progress on these, what I think are good ideas. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Good morning, Co-Chair Gelser and Wingard and members of the committee. I'm Sue Hildick with the Chalkboard Project. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about this issue in this session. We know your time is limited, but this is a pretty critical leverage point for reform in Oregon. And all the states are having this conversation, particularly those that are seeking a waiver from No Child Left Behind. The first 10 states were granted their waivers this morning. It'll be fascinating to see what their applications have in them regarding educator effectiveness. We want to also thank you for 290. 290 put in place the framework that we need to have this conversation, and it is probably one of the most localized educator effectiveness bills in the country, in that it really allows a local district to develop their performance evaluation system around the standards that the state has adopted. We think that's a great example of the tight, loose language that the governor is using. So we've got the standards. We've now got a timeline in which districts are working to revamp their systems. What we need is additional guidance. And what has changed since you passed 290 is the waiver process and the federal government stating what their expectations are, which is this minimum number of levels of proficiency for teachers and principals, and then the use of significant. I want to add a little flavor here about the chalkboard class districts, which have been well along the path of revamping their performance evaluation systems. We have 16 districts across the state now engaged in that work. That represents 25% of the students in Oregon. The smallest is Vernonia, the biggest is Salem. These are very different dynamics across these districts where a collaborative process is yielding a different design. It's pretty impressive to watch. We have some amazing leadership across the state. And, you know, Chalkboard doesn't come in and say, here's the model. What we do is feed the process with research and with a coach. And what's coming out of that are significant measures of student achievement, multiple levels of proficiency, just the kinds of things that the federal government is asking us to consider. All of the class districts have multiple levels, at least four levels of proficiency. All of them have some piece of student achievement in the performance evaluation. What does significant mean there? Well, it ranges. And I will talk in percentages, although we don't favor the state setting a state-mandated percentage. But in some of the class districts, it's 20%. In some, it's 80%. That's determined locally given their condition. So I think what you're doing here is providing a deeper context to the 290 framework, and I think it's really important. One of the things that we're concerned about is the small districts and the capacity issues, and large districts too. We recently funded the High Desert ESD to reach out to the 23 districts in their catch net to help them with 290. We think that's a model that could work with other ESDs. We're going to need that kind of coaching and support because these are hard conversations, and we do them in the context of the local conditions, but we think state leadership is really important here, and that's why this bill moves us forward down the path. The last thing, I just wanted to respond to Representative Frederick's comment about capacity. It's significant. Another thing to think about is peer review. That's a growing movement across the country. We're looking at that. There is a district in Oregon, Lebanon, that's really interested in piloting some of that peer review work, so that's another piece of building our capacity. And I want to put in the record the list of the work group from the waiver process who debated this issue for some time. Kate Dixon of our team helped lead that with Rob Hess, the superintendent of Lebanon, and also the specific language that was submitted that pretty much mirrors what's in the bill before you today. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association here in support of House Bill 4102. The top priority for our members is improving student achievement, and I think it's everyone in this room knows that socioeconomic status is probably the biggest determining factor before students get to school, how they're going to perform in our schools. But once they get to school, the research is very clear that a high-quality teacher can make the biggest difference in closing academic achievement gaps and improving student achievement. And administrators and principals are, in most of the research, are right behind teachers on those lists. So we all know we have great teachers and administrators here in Oregon, and House Bill 4102 is an important step to making sure we have great and high-quality evaluations as well. And I won't repeat some of the points, but we know that we've applied for a waiver, and this bill mirrors the waiver, as Sue just mentioned. In the past, the state and federal governments have not been very heavily involved in teacher and principal evaluations. It's been a very localized issue. But I just got back from a lobbying trip to Washington, D.C., and it's very clear that this topic of evaluations is one of the dominant themes at the federal level in education reform as it is here. Both the waiver process that the U.S. Department of Education has put out requires teacher and principal evaluations. Both the House and Senate versions of ESEA, No Child Left Behind reauthorization, have similar language requiring teacher and administrator evaluations. So wouldn't it be nice if we here in Oregon took this opportunity to design a local system that's flexible for our school districts and our employees, and rather than getting some prescriptive system foisted on us from D.C. So that's a good opportunity here. And I think, you know, a lot of the points that I was going to make have already been said, but I think one of the challenges when we talk about evaluations is we need to shift our mindset here in Oregon and probably across the nation. In the past, evaluations, we've always talked about experience and qualifications and credentials. And so we're stuck with situations like we have right now. One of our school board members that went out with us to D.C., Sam Lee, who's the school board chair down in Winston-Dillard, which is in Douglas County, a smaller school district. Because of the highly qualified teacher requirements in No Child Left Behind, they literally have teachers that drive back and forth between the high school and the middle school. So the systems we have in place to determine what's a good teacher or say who's a good teacher are clearly not working. And we need to shift to a conversation about quality and effectiveness. Our members certainly don't want a punitive system of evaluations or a gotcha system of evaluations. I know that concern has sort of raised its head here this morning. If we do this right, our evaluations can support professional development for educators and help all of us achieve our ultimate goal, which is improving student achievement. And with that, I think most of the other things I wanted to mention have been said, so I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
If I may, just one comment. Thank you, Representative Gelser. I was just last week was in Eugene for a conference, for a banquet for the African American History Month, and the Bethel School District was specifically honored for the approach that they were taking and the success that they had had, and it was a matter of supporting the teachers and the parents and the community there, not necessarily, as you said, something that was a punitive situation. They managed to bring up the achievement level of minority kids in that district to an incredible level, much, much higher than they even expected. And they were literally marching around with their heads held high just to get an award there. But it's the kind of thing, are these the tools that you're talking about? I'm just curious. Everyone seems to be wanting to deal with tools. What tools are you suggesting that the teachers will get, or that the administrators will get, to make this effective?
Co-chairs of Representative Frederick, I can comment on Bethel because we've been working there with them for some time and helped them with their performance evaluation process, and they have recently applied for 252 money to the State Department of Ed to do collaborative reform around the four buckets of professional development, career ladders, compensation, and evaluation. So I think they are well invested in their workforce issues and trying hard to put a comprehensive model in place. So I would say yes, they're linked.
Madam Chair,
yes. So the class districts, how do they get around the problem of collective bargaining?
co-chairs and Representative Dembro. We do class within the context of collective bargaining. So, we work within that system. Some districts have done MOUs at the end of the process to modify their contracts. That's the most typical situation we've seen. But a lot of them haven't needed to do any modification. I mean, it really is that essence of, is it truly collaborative? You know, are we really building something together that has been successful? And in the districts where we haven't had success, that's been lacking.
So I guess as a follow-up, would you be opposed to modifying this bill so that it clarified that all of this would be done within the context of collective bargaining, you know, through memos of understanding or actually, you know, through, you know, as part of a negotiated settlement?
Co-chairs, Representative Dembro, we're pretty comfortable with the language in the bill. We think Representative Johnson has laid out language that will encourage collaboration, so we're comfortable as it is.
But you would not be in favor of something that specifically, stated that, you know, these are the options that would then be agreed to locally, with the represented agent, the elected representatives of the teachers.
Co-chairs, Representative Dembro, the bill lays out a locally driven process. The state
but locally
is providing
by the district. I mean, by the
yeah.
school board.
Right.
But in terms of true collaboration, where it was sort of equals coming together at the table, that generally is done through collective bargaining. That's what collective bargaining is all about.
You know, we're having tremendous success in a large number of school districts covering a lot of kids now, and I think that this bill is in the same spirit as what we're seeing with class, so we're comfortable with the language.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Next, I would invite David Wilkinson, Maureen Barnhart, and Autumn Wilburn. We'll wait and have you come up in a second panel, then there's both of you. Welcome. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Good morning. Co-Chair Gelser, Co-Chair Wingard, members of the committee, my name is David Wilkinson. I teach English in the Beaverton School District when I'm not serving as the Beaverton Education Association president. I'm here to speak in opposition to House Bill 4102. The Beaverton School District has worked collaboratively since 2005 to create and refine our teacher evaluation system. As teachers, we welcome an evaluation system that helps us improve as professionals. In Beaverton, our evaluation process focuses on clearly stated instructional domains and standards to help us become better educators. This is meaningful to us because we were at the table developing those standards, working side by side with administration. When Senate Bill 290 passed last session, we were encouraged to see it put forth language to involve educators and administrators in the creation of an evaluation system, much like what we have done in Beaverton. It required the state school board to adopt core teaching standards that were able to address the desire teachers have to constantly improve their practice through effective assessment of student outcomes. The Oregon Model Core Teaching Standards in TASC dedicate a whole standard to assessment of student learning. The standard serves as a significant indicator of how teachers are required to enhance and elevate their instructional practice through analyzing student assessment data and utilizing it to inform and adjust their instruction accordingly. In-task requires teachers will be evaluated through various measures or whether or not they are consistently incorporating the standard into their practice. I also encourage the committee to consider that the most holistic and complete picture of performance in any profession is best gained via multiple measures, and House Bill 4102 limits the primary focus to two, observations and student data. There are far more sophisticated tools to use, including analysis of artifacts, teacher portfolios, evidence showing change over time. Whatever measure are used, they can and should be decided upon locally, providing the most complete picture of both the art and science of teaching. Senate Bill 290 also left enough flexibility in the language to allow districts like Beaverton and others who have developed strong evaluation systems to leave them in place and align them to in-task through a collaborative process. We are opposed to House Bill 4102 because it does not allow the same flexibility and collaboration. For instance, it requires that teachers be placed in four categories, and although there are school districts, including Beaverton, that use four categories, some do not. Some have three, some have five. It is important to note that more levels within an evaluation system more levels of an evaluation system, the smaller the differences will be between the levels, which means evaluators must be highly skilled in their ability to understand and accurately distinguish the changes. There's also currently no agreement in the education or research community on the optimal number of categories for an evaluation system. With a lack of research, it is important to remember that this is an opportunity to develop what works locally and have the flexibility to refine the levels as districts journey through their pilot. I'd also note all of the provisions in House Bill 4102 are allowed under Senate Bill 290. And in fact, Beaverton has adopted some of them, but we don't assume that everything that has worked in Beaverton will work for all school districts in Oregon. A collaborative effort helps to build trust in a school district evaluation process. We are asking you to vote no so teachers and school districts can continue to build collaborative evaluation systems. We're happy to see Representative Johnson has pushed out the implementation date to 2013, but we still believe Senate Bill 290 should be implemented and examined before it is preemptively changed. Further, the Dash 3 amendments for 4102 include observations of performance standards outside the classroom. We find this section unnecessary because TSPC already has authority to take disciplinary action, including license revocation, for issues outside the classroom. I understand some of the changes proposed in House Bill 4102 were included because they are similar to parts of Oregon's NCLB waiver application. I, too, was honored to sit on the OEIB subcommittee for the NCLB waiver. Committee members did not expect that aspects of that waiver would be cemented into law, nor did we expect new legislation to usurp our work. Instead, we intend the waiver to be a working document to help Oregon get out from under the failed NCLB law. If the United States Department of Education requires legislation in order for Oregon to get the waiver, we can have that discussion. But let's make clear determinations about what will be most effective before we adopt legislation. I also, for the purposes of today, want to make a couple quick comments about 4161, if that is appropriate with the chair.
Unfortunately, that bill is not open yet, but we will come back up and we can sign you back up for that.
Okay,
when that bill
I can literally give you two sentences if you would be okay with that.
Unfortunately, it's not a personal thing; it's just a process thing. We're not open on that bill.
I understand.
So it would not go into the record.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Maureen Barnhart, and I'm a teacher in the Hillsborough School District. And we have not been referred to in these discussions when people comment on other districts that have an evaluation plan in place. But in 1999, I was fortunate enough to be on the committee of teachers and principals and district administrators who worked on an evaluation form. Until that point, we had something from the state that was two sides of a sheet of paper. And now we have a booklet that seemed intimidating, and it took a long time to come to that booklet, but it's based on Charlotte Danielson's research on the four I don't know how many domains she has. We have four. So ours is not exactly like Beaverton's, even though we're right next door to them, but it really works well for us, and the conversations have been good. It's just something that has helped change the culture in our schools, where we have professional learning groups now that look at these domains. And so we feel like we would not want to give up all the work that has helped us improve our school district. There was a question about whether it was used, I think, for plans of improvement, and yes, it is. It gives us a common language to use when we come to plans for improvement. So it's like the rubrics we use with our students. The teachers know what's expected, and they're on the same page with that, and they know how they're expected to show their competency. And it is evaluated on does not meet, meets, or is proficient.
Thank you.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Gelser and Wingert and members of the committee. For the record, Autumn Wilburn, Oregon Department of Education. I just wanted to say thank you to Representative Johnson for reaching out to the department to work with us on the language in this bill, and especially on the timeline. If this bill is to go forward, we felt that a push out of the implementation date was important. And really, with the next panel, you're going to hear from the department, from Colleen Milahem, about more information on the teacher and administrator evaluation portion of Oregon's ESEA waiver and the collaborative process surrounding the timeline and the work that's contained therein.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? And I just want to thank you both. Most of us in the room get to spend time together every day. I know that you both have taken a personal day from your classrooms to come and be here today. So thank you for taking the time to do that, and thank your students for sharing you with us.
Thank you.
Our next panel would be
Colleen Milham and Jim Green.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Colleen Milham at the Department of Education. And my purpose here is just to provide you with some information concerning the waiver process and the role of the waiver within all of this work. One of the things that's been transpiring over the last year especially is the whole notion of a collaborative process around educator effectiveness. And educator effectiveness being very comprehensive around preparation, around licensure, around mentoring and induction, all of those areas, evaluation being one of those pieces. So we're constantly looking at that holistic approach to it and then also focusing on this one element of evaluation as the NCLB waiver asks us to do in terms of our application. Just want to clarify for you the next steps in this waiver process. We have submitted our waiver, and Principle 3 really gets at teacher and administrator evaluation. We submitted a plan, and we have the opportunity now over the next 5 months to develop guidance and a specific framework on that plan. And the elements that you've been hearing about this morning are a part of that plan. So we have moved forward to invite our work group back together, and they'll begin that work of getting that greater detail around those elements and in a collaborative way. So the next piece that must be done, though, in terms of our waiver, because we've signed an assurance for the United States Department of Education, is that we will submit our state-level guidance framework by the end of June. So the State Board of Education is also engaged in this process and very, very interested in watching the progress and also discussing the policy around this. So we will be moving this forward over the next few months, engaging partners and getting input from the various partners across the state, because that is something certainly that the board asks us to do around this process. So that's just basically an update for you on information concerning the waiver.
Mr. Green.
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green, today representing the Oregon Small Schools Association. And as I sat back in the hearing room, I realized how long I've been doing this now, because I remember being in this exact room where the legislature reinstituted continuing professional development for teachers. We had a period of time where we didn't have that. So we have moved a long way in this debate and discussion, because we recognize it as a very valuable profession. We instituted continuing professional development, working with teachers at TSPC and school districts to do that. Now we're talking about evaluation. And we all know that the data and the research shows that one of the most important things we can do to increase student achievement and increase student academic instruction is to have the best teacher in front of them. And I think that's what this bill is about. I want to thank Representative Johnson for bringing it forward. Originally, when he showed me his draft, I said, well, Representative Johnson, I don't think the small schools can get there with you. And he was willing to work with us on amendments. I think the Dash 3 are what I'm here to testify in support of today. And one of the things real quickly that I think was brought up with regard to small schools is with regard to resources. I'll give you an example of a school district that is a member of my association, the Burnt River School District. I don't know if any of you have ever been to the Burnt River School District. It's in Unity, Oregon. It has 28 students in it. Their superintendent is not only the superintendent, she's also the instructional leader, she's the assessment leader, she's also teaches two classes, and she's the substitute bus driver in that school district. So when we're talking about multitasking in a small school district, this is a superintendent who multitasks. She has told me that their evaluation system has worked very well, but it would work better with some sort of statewide standards in place, which I think 290 from last session brought us forward. This bill brings us to the next step. And I want to thank Representative Johnson for allowing amendments to come into the bill that allow school districts to work in consortiums and work collaboratively with ESDs, because the districts I represent, their resources are at the breaking point with regard to being able to provide services and education program to their boys and girls. This is one more thing on top of it, but I think working collaboratively with those entities, you'll be able to do that. And the ESDs that serve these small school districts, they've indicated they're willing to step up to the plate and be the people that will work with them in order to do that. Because when you have a superintendent doing that many things, adding an evaluation process on top of that is something that they look at me and say, Jim, really, is this something else the state wants to do? And then they talk about how we talk about student instruction and improving that, and they realize getting to that next level requires a system like this. So 290 was a step in the right direction. This bill takes it to the next level. I will say that in order for many of my clients across the state to implement something like this, and even 290 is going to be resource driven. They are stretched to their capacity and they will need additional resources. But we believe that the Dash 3 amendments allow us to work collaboratively. It'll do good things for kids because ultimately we're not about trying to fire teachers at the school board level across the state. What we're about is improving student instruction, improving student achievement, and making sure that the professionals that are in front of our kids each and every day have the ability to provide them with the best educational program they have. Putting in a strong evaluation system only strengthens their ability to do that. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And are there any brief questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. And with that, I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 40.
Madam Chair?
Yes?
Could I get Representative Johnson for 30 seconds?
For 30 seconds, because we have a lot of work to do in not many minutes.
And I apologize.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
I'm always bad this way.
I could work out an exchange with you.
We won't. Yeah, never mind.
Am I still on the record?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, quick question.
Oh, but you need to reintroduce yourself one more time for the tape. I'm sorry.
For the record, Mark Johnson, State Rep for House District 52.
Representative, your response to Beaverton and Hillsborough, mm-hmm. if you would please, would this bill put them in a predicament or would there be allowances there?
One of the, if you actually read the fine print in the bill, I know it came out that there are four levels described in there. The bill says at least four. If you have five, that's fine, because there are districts around the state, I know like Springfield, that employ a five-level differentiated system right now. They're fine. I think that, obviously, they are way down the road in Beaverton with what they're doing. That's great, and I think that that could be obviously enfolded into this, and I personally wouldn't see any issues with that. That would be my response.
Okay,
thank
great.
You, Representative.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4102 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4161. Erin, would you give a brief overview? And our panel would be Lori Wimmer, Lisa Frack, and David Wilkinson.
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4161 requires Oregon Department of Education to collect performance report data for each school year regarding number of teachers and number of students assigned to each course offered by public educational providers, requires ODE to collect performance report data only if funding is available from federal or state resources. It is effective July 1, 2012. We did receive a Dash 1 amendment. It was came in this morning to staff, and it is before you today. Just briefly summarizing it, the Dash 1 amendment defines class size data. It defines public educational provider, requires Oregon Department of Education to collect from every public educational provider number of students in each class, number of sections taught for each licensed or registered teacher, number of licensed or registered teachers providing instruction for public educational provider, number of administrators employed in the district, and then based on this data, the department shall calculate the class size data for each school or school district, ESD, Oregon School for Deaf, or the Youth Corrections Education Program, and within this data must collect information on specific courses related to reading, language art or English, and mathematics in grades 3 through 8 and grade 11.
And I regret to inform you all that I have made a severe error. Representative Comp would like to introduce her bill. So could we have Representative Comp come up?
Well, I could do it from here.
Okay, great. Thank you all for being flexible with me.
I have a couple of handouts if Erin would take care of these. I need one. thank you, committee members, Chair Gelser, Chair Wingert. For the record, my name is Betty Kopp. I serve in House District 22. And this is a bill that I wanted to bring forward because when you see whether it's data from No Child Left Behind or your own school district, it doesn't give you, it tells you how many students in your school, how many professionals in your school, but it doesn't tell you how many of those professionals are actually teaching in the classroom. The goal of this bill is to have better data. Yes, I am a data geek, and so that we can really explain to our citizens in our communities just how many students are in their classes. Aaron's handing out a prototype piece from the quality education model. And we talked about, and some of the presenters might talk about the terminology. How do you define a class, a course? What is the terminology? And actually, we're trying to help define some of those things. In high school, they're all called courses. In elementary school, you may have two teachers, team teaching. Of course, that happens at all levels. And what we want to do, though, is to try to decipher how many students are in that English class and how many students are in that math class. We're not asking to have, well, if you really wanted an eye-opener, you'd ask how many students are in a PE class. And that number's been anywhere from 35 to 65 for the past 20 years. And I know that there are PE teachers that I don't know how they do it. But anyway, the QEM gives you a little bit of a guidance what we would look at, and so that you would know. And I would use the example of the special education teacher or the second language person. Their class sizes may be appreciably smaller, and that is because the demands and the needs of those students is so much greater. And so, yes, we're just looking for some clarity and to help our communities to make better decisions. We are trying to bring this decision-making to our local school boards and our communities so that everybody can understand what's going on. And this is particularly a pivotal moment because the department is working with a new data system. We've gotten federal grants. We just accepted another one yesterday in Ways and Means for our data system so that we can get this data and have some transparency and better decision making. With that, Madam Chair, thank you for a couple of minutes, and I'm sure our presenters have some good perspectives too.
Thank you, Representative Compton. Again, my apologies for...
It's early in the morning, Chair Gelser. It's very early in the morning.
Thank you, Representative Compton. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, and your committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing the Oregon Education Association. Thank you so much for hearing this bill today, and thank you to Representative Comp for sponsoring it. We are here in support of House Bill 4161 because we, as you've heard, believe that this will provide a little truth in advertising about the experience, the learning experience of our students in Oregon's public school classrooms. We have, as you know, lost somewhere in the neighborhood of 10,000 education employees in the last 2 years because of our current crisis level budgets on the heels of the Great Recession. I think there's no better time for us to take a look at what it is that those funding cuts have meant to our students and their ability to achieve the ambitions we have for them than to take a snapshot of what the actual class sizes are. We know that a small teacher-to-student classroom size is an educational best practice, as Representative Comp mentioned by handing out the prototype of the quality education model schools. Smaller classes bring an increased teacher morale, a greater degree of direct instruction, particularly extra supports for struggling learners, fewer disruptions and student behavior issues, greater engagement by kids in their learning, and improvements in such indicators as dropout rates, grade level retention, and number of students who aspire to attend college. All of the things that our OEIB process and 40-40-20 goals speak to, which are now in our laws. And yet we don't collect this important information in Oregon. The Department of Education and school districts themselves look at what I call a mathematical fiction. They take the total number of enrolled students and divide it by the total number of employed adults, and that is your average class size ratio. And that is a distorted number at best, and we don't believe it provides the kind of information that policymakers need, that advocates need, certainly that parents need, and even our members need to make good decisions about whether or not we are providing optimal circumstances for our students. So House Bill 4161 would direct the districts to report actual class sizes and for the department to compile that information and give it to you all once a year. One of the things that I point out is that researchers on education issues also have been crying out for a long time that they don't get accurate class size data in most states. And what they say is that it's important to understand a distinction in terminology. Class size is the number of students who are enrolled in a particular teacher's classroom and for whom that teacher is responsible. By contrast, student-teacher ratios are the number of students in a given educational unit measured against the full-time licensed educators assigned to that unit. So this could include the school counselor, technology specialist, TOSA, and other education professionals. And so that ratio does not accurately describe the conditions for learning of in the classrooms of students. So true class sizes will be able to say, for example, if you have a class of 15 students and one teacher, you have a class size of 15. If you have a class size of 30 students, we could hope, and an aide or a second teacher, you have a class size of 30, which has implications for space consideration, time management, and student behavior, to name just a few, even when a student can still get more individualized instruction with two adults to that number of kids. So ratios are not the same thing as class size for appreciating the educational outcomes that you might engender. So this bill is before you today so that we can go beyond the artificially depressed average and give you a better sense of true class size data as a foundation for better understanding of the learning experience of our children. Now, I'll say one other thing, and that is that we originally had the aspiration to capture that information for 20,000 classrooms in Oregon. That's all of them. But we realized that given funding shortfalls, that would put an undue burden on the department, and that would also create a fiscal impact, and we didn't want to have either of those impairments. We also understood that we don't want to add more burdens to our administrators. We have just come before you with the idea of reducing the mandate and reporting workload, and we're trying to be sensitive to that too. Now, they do collect that data. They have to. They have to know how many staff to hire, what classrooms to assign their teachers and their students to. So they do have that data at their fingertips, and they are reporting it under the Alder grant for reading and math in 3 through 8 and 11. So our amendments move backward and capture just that data for the time being. And should we have a more affluent state at some point in the future such that we can better fund our schools and our Department of Education, we'd like to move beyond that pilot collection and ultimately do class size reporting for all. But for now, we would consider it a very successful pilot were we to be able to just collect the data that they already have to report through the Alder system. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome back. And you, unfortunately, have to introduce yourself again.
Again, my name is David Wilkinson. I am the president of the Beaverton Education Association. I was not planning on speaking to this issue today, but I'm glad that this committee is discussing it, because I to say that class sizes are at crisis levels in Oregon is a gross understatement. The best way I could say this, frankly, is that my colleagues are drowning. You can take the best master teacher, the most accomplished, most knowledgeable about their subject matter, the most effective educator you can find, and put them in an overcrowded classroom, and they will get diminishing returns, period. To continue having the kinds of class sizes that we have now is a recipe to continue to degrade what I think is the most valuable asset we have in this democracy, which is our public education that takes care of our children. As the best way that I can describe that, and again, the way that I would put it is simply that when someone is put in a classroom with that many students, meaningful instruction devolves, and you're essentially relegated to having to engage in crowd control. Our kids deserve better than that. Our teachers deserve better than that. Our community and the future of our economy deserves better than that. We need to do better at class size in this state, period. I find it ironic, as I was coming to Salem this morning, driving down, OPB was running a piece about increases in enrollment in private schools. I don't know if any of the rest of you heard this as you were driving down. At least two of the parents who spoke in that and were quoted in that piece said, and I'm paraphrasing, but essentially, I believe in the public school system. However, class sizes have become so large in the public school system that I am essentially forced to pay tuition and put my child in private school. That to me is a failure of our system. And part of what I know this bill seeks to do is bring to light what really is happening. And I believe that the numbers that most people are working from are flawed. I believe that most folks in the public, frankly, really don't believe we have a problem. And the sort of deceptive nature of the way we are reporting out data, I believe, feeds that problem. The other piece, I guess, as an educator, I really wish to stress, and looking at all of the education reforms that we've talked about today, looking at the way we are seeking to evaluate teachers, what teachers do and the real service that we provide is evaluating students. The skill that I have as an English teacher is that I can look at a student's essay, help them know where are you in terms of the standards of where you ought to be on your path to college and on your path to other success, and I can provide them very specific and meaningful feedback because I understand that very clearly. However, when you increase my class sizes to the astronomical levels that they have gone to, my ability to provide that meaningful feedback diminishes with each additional child, all of them deserving, all of them needing, but not getting what they need. So what I would say in support of this bill is the public has the right to know what's really going on. And what is happening is our education system is being degraded due to lack of resources, and the very good people who I represent, the teachers in this state, are doing the very best they can with diminished and woefully inadequate resources. The public needs to understand that clearly, and to understand that clearly, they need better, cleaner, more meaningful data. Thank you.
I'm Lisa Frack, and I'm a parent of two children in public school in Portland, a kindergartner and a third grader. I'm also the chair of our Elementary School Foundation, which is a local school foundation set up in Portland under the Portland Public Schools Foundation, which is how we raise money to pay for staff. It's separate than the PTA. It doesn't pay for fun stuff. It pays for people because we need more of them. I'd like to think we're funding new staff, but what we're really doing is stopping the bleeding, more or less. And trying to preserve our program as it is, which we are failing to do despite trying to raise $150,000 a year in a school that has 38% free and reduced lunch kids. And it's not an easy job. I'm also the communications director for Family Forward Oregon, which is kind of the hat that I have on here today. And thank you, Representative Kopp, for putting the bill forward, and to the chairs for the opportunity to speak in support of 4161. Not to reiterate all of the articulate things that the educators have said, I'm not an educator, I'm a parent on the how come I can't get more information from my teacher? Oh, right, he's got 27 kids, and that's where I'm coming from. But I think in this bill, just to be brief, we need the right data. So, you know, if my kid has 27 kids in his class in second grade, which is really challenging for a boy, I have found. It's a corralling job. But it's not 18 kids. We have a lot of fabulous adults in our school, and they're not all teachers. And so doing the average doesn't work out. I'm glad those adults are there. We've lost some of them, too, and they're critical. But that doesn't affect the number that are actually in the classroom trying to get them to sit down and pay attention. And so having the right data just seems like a no-brainer to move on and make whatever decisions come after that. And I guess that's really it. And I would say just about the PE classes. Our PE class has zero kids in it now because we lost our PE teacher last year. So 35 to 65 looks kind of good. Thank you for the opportunity to support the bill.
Thank you, Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Representative Gelser. Just one question. What school?
Buckman Elementary.
Buckman. Okay. Just south of me, so I know it. I know it very well.
Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess it's a question for you or Aaron. Do we have a fiscal on this yet?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Dimbrough, we do not have a fiscal on it, nor do we have a fiscal on the dash one.
Okay. The reason I ask is that I know when we were first talking about this bill, there were some concerns about, you know, the costs of doing this tracking, and I believe that this dash one amendment was an attempt to eliminate those concerns. And so I guess a question for Lori, is it your sense that that those concerns have been met in this dash one?
Co-chairs and Representative Dimbrough, we did work with the department to make sure that the language of the bill would be such that it would eliminate their fiscal concerns.
And just to follow up, and this is essentially using data that they're collecting already under the Alder Project.
Co-chairs and Representative Dimbrough, yes, they have three federal grants for the Alder Project, and this data, these data are being collected already.
Thank you.
Well, thank you all very much, and thank you for bringing this bill. I know as a parent of four kids in public schools, their classes are absolutely enormous, and I am, especially at the middle and high school level, am in awe of their teachers' ability to provide such individualized attention to each of them and track so many kids when I know that they have about 150 kids that they're seeing over the course of a day. It's mind-boggling to me. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, we did receive testimony from Dana Hepper for Stanford Children. It was at the dais this morning on regards to this bill.
Thank you very much. And with that, we are going to, is there anyone else that wants to be heard on 4161? We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4161. And the committee is going to stand in recess for a couple of minutes.
How many minutes?
How many minutes? I don't know. How many minutes should we pick? Like
you
five?
Asked
I know.
Last time. You have
what do you
to
think?
Set a
five
number.
Minutes? Okay. Let's pick five.
Okay.
Five
more
minutes.
More than a bathroom break, couple, less than a house lounge break.
Well, it's a
Committee on Education is back in order. And here's the agenda, so I have all the numbers.
Right. Can I borrow this from there? Yeah.
Okay. So thank you for the great public hearings today on both House Bill 4102 and 4161. I think both were great starts to conversations, and we are not going to be moving forward on a work session on those at this time, but I'm sure that conversations will continue. With that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 4013. Yes, and there is an amendment on that. It's the dash one. Is that correct?
Run through the bill really quick.
Yes, would you run through the bill to help us remember?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4013 directs Superintendent of Public Instruction to provide specified information for the purpose of assisting school districts and high schools and increasing availability of advanced placement courses. There's a dash one amendment. It replaces the reference to advanced placement courses with accelerated learning entity, defines meaning of accelerated learning entity, requires Superintendent of Public Instruction to make information available on the website of the Oregon Department of Education to high schools based on the extent this information is available to the superintendent. There is a no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact, no statement issued on the dash one amendment. We did have a public hearing on the 7th.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair.
I would move the dash one amendments to House Bill 4013.
Co-Chair Wingard moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 4013. Is there any discussion? With none, I would just really like to thank Representative Huffman, Representative Comp, and Mr. Marquis for their and the department for their flexibility and assistance in getting something together that we could move. It was a great conversation, and everyone worked together really well, and it's great when things work that way in this building. So thank you all for making it possible for this, for us to move this thing.
Thank you for thanking me.
Thank you for thanking me for thanking you. And if there is no further discussion, could we call the roll, please?
Representative Demarest.
Aye.
Representative Huffman.
Aye.
Representative Kopp.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
The Vice Chair Conger.
Aye.
The Vice Chair Frederick.
Aye.
Co-Chair Wingard.
Aye.
Co-Chair Galston.
Aye. Having received the required votes, the motion passes, and House Bill 4013 will go to the floor.
Oh, we have to do the dash one.
On the dash one.
The dash one.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair.
I would move House Bill 4013 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Chair Wingard moves House Bill 4013 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes, and now House Bill 4013 will go to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Representative Huffman and Representative Comp, would you co-carry the bill, please?
Representative Comp has volunteered to carry it. So.
Thank you very much. So Representative Comp will carry the bill, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 4013. I will open a work session on House Bill 4014.
You can just talk about the two amendments.
The dash threes and the dash fours. Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4014 is effectively officially known as the Mandate Relief Bill. It abolishes direct business practices advisory and authority to conduct best business practice audits, removes requirement for school districts to collect data related to physical education and nutrition. It also removes the requirement that school district boards determine whether school district is in compliance with food standards and reports results to the Oregon Department of Education, removes requirement state board of education to mediate resolution between school district board and applicant for public charter school, removes requirement of observations of Arbor Week, history of Oregon Statehood Week, and Women in History Week, removes requirement that ODE report to legislative assembly on implementation of courses on family life, HIV, and human sexuality, and removes requirement that school districts provide instructional materials on explicit phonics. Allow school districts to adopt or use textbooks or other instructional materials in place of addition of those adopted by the State Board of Education and without giving prior notice. There is an emergency clause on this measure. We have a dash three amendment before you, which restores the school nutrition provisions and restores the physical education provisions. You have a dash four amendment as well, and it allows school district board to adopt class schedule that operates throughout the year for all or any schools in the district, removing requirement that school district board may not require a student to attend the entire year, and removes requirement on how school districts implement academic excellence recognition programs. There is a no revenue impact on both of those amendments. There is a fiscal statement impact on both of those amendments as well.
Madam Chair.
Co-Chair Wingard.
I'd move the dash three amendments to House Bill 4014.
Co-Chair Wingard moves the dash three amendments to House Bill 4014. Is there any discussion? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to reiterate again for the record that in the reporting, I strongly encourage postcard, one-sheet type reporting. These reports, and I've talked to a number of the supporters, they don't need to be extremely large or detailed. So, thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Representative Parrish.
Well, I'm going to comment to the school lunch one. USDA does have pretty stringent standards. It's constantly changing. I think that it's sometimes on that program, having run that program as a food service nutrition director in a school district, it's just helpful to follow one set of standards and let USDA establish a standard for all 50 states and apply it equally amongst schools. And I have no problem putting this back in, but as this body looks at those things in the future, I think that it's important to recognize that, you know, standards that are applied consistently across states when it's federal dollars is probably a standard that we should stick to and make it less confusing for the folks who are serving lunch, you know, 500 kids in a three-hour period, and make their job a little bit easier. So,
thank you, Representative Parrish. And I would just say, God bless those that feed our kids at lunchtime at schools. It's a big project, big job.
Madam Chair,
yes.
When you're done.
I'm really happy that we're able to restore this language. Those of us that were here in 2007 will remember the tremendous work that Representative Bruhn and Representative Kotek and many others put into addressing nutrition standards for our a la carte lines, our snack shacks, and our vending machines. And I think it's important that we honor the work that they did and that everyone worked together to get across. And I think, you know, we've just heard moments ago about a PE teacher that's gone. We really can't even appear to be stepping back from good health for our kids around nutrition and PE standards. Representative Huffman.
Thank you. Just to follow up on Representative Parrish, I totally agree. If there's a federal standard, and that's typically what our schools are trying to meet, and if there's a reporting requirement for that, if they can just submit that report to the state, that would be more than fine. Been doing some work this past interim in my district with some of the food supervisors, dietitians at different school districts. I, in fact, 2 weeks ago, donated a computer to the Head Start program and the DALS because there's some really cool software out there right now that some educational districts are being able to buy to help with the nutrition and menus in their school districts. And so there is some good stuff going on out there.
Thank you very much. Any further discussion? Representative Wingard.
Madam Chair, I just want to say, Representative Parrish, if you or your lunch ladies were responsible for the delicious corn that I always had at school, I think.
The roll, the big fluffy rolls.
The rolls were good too, but I loved the corn. Thank you.
I'll remember that.
We obviously did not go to the same school. Representative Frederick.
Well, let me just say that if you ever get a chance to have dinner cooked by this lady, do it. She is terrific. Absolutely terrific.
That's true.
Who's about to say young lady?
Is there any further discussion about this amendment or what people would like to have for lunch? Seeing none, is there any objection to the amendment? Seeing none, the motion passes. Co-Chair Wingard.
Madam Chair, I'd move the dash four amendments to House Bill 4014.
Representative Wingard moves the dash four amendments to House Bill 4014. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes. Representative Wingard.
Madam Chair, I'd move House Bill 4014 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Representative Wingard moves House Bill 4014 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion carries and it goes to the floor. I will carry the bill and I will close the work session on House Bill 4014 and I will open a work session on House Bill 4015.
Have someone else make
it. Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4015 requires Oregon Health Authority to develop and maintain lead poisoning prevention clearinghouse on its website. Specifies information that must be included in lead poisoning prevention clearinghouse. There is a no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement was issued on the measure. There are no amendments to the measure.
Representative Conger.
You want me to make the motion?
I would like you to make the motion.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4015 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Conger moves House Bill 4015 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, House Bill 4015 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Conger and Representative Frederick, would you guys co-carry the bill?
Certainly. That'd be great. Thank you.
All right. And we will close the work session on House Bill 4015. Unfortunately, we are not going to work House Bill 4016, which is a great disappointment. And with that, we will close today's. Is there any other business for today?
Yield.
Anything else for today? Seeing none, we will close the committee. We're adjourned.